Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. That sound is the call of the common loon. While loons are not a part of the Oklahoma lake ecosystems, for the lakes of the Northeast and the big woods of Canada and upper Midwest, loons are a charismatic species. For that haunting call, for the breeding pairs that return year after year to the same nesting grounds and the same lakes and ponds, and for a few myths as well, which unfortunately we'll dispel a few of in a moment. My guest today is Dr. Walter Piper, who's been studying loon behavior and their territoriality for over 20 years. His work has involved following loon populations on about 100 northern Wisconsin lakes, studying their monogamous mating patterns, their extreme territoriality, and many other characteristics of the bird. Piper is a professor of earth and environmental sciences at Chapman University and the author of numerous scientific articles and publications. He also has an excellent webpage that describes his research to laypeople at loonproject.org. He'll be speaking about his research this afternoon at 3 o'clock at Oliphant Hall at room 300 on the University of Tulsa campus, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Walter Piper, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
For 22 years, you've been studying the behavior of the common loon. And here in Oklahoma, we'll never hear a loon called. But up in the far north woods in Canada, and especially in Wisconsin and Minnesota and upper peninsula of Michigan and in the Northeast, the loon is it has a real significance because of some of the thoughts we think about the loon. Of course, your research has dispelled some of that. The fact that they mate for life, for example.
Right.
But what got you interested in studying loon behavior?
Well, when I was a child, I would go with my family up to a lake where my grandparents had bought some property up in central Ontario. And at that time, or on those lakes, we would not be able to approach loons very closely. They were extremely skittish. But at night in particular, on these large, this huge lake, Tomogamy Lake, where we had cabins, we would hear the loon calls echoing over the water. And my mother, who's also interested in birds, drew my attention to the loon calls, knowing that I was interested in birds. And every once in a while, I would see a loon at a distance. And so the birds always had some sort of power over me, I guess you could say. I've always been intrigued by loons, but I didn't know that years later I would begin to study them. I would like to say that it was science that carried me to loons. In a way, it did. But initially, I was studying white-throated sparrows, which I had begun to study. I studied for my graduate work at University of North Carolina, and I was hand-rearing some of them in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and in order to do some very simple behavioral experiments on them. And I lived at a field station where there's a fellow who had refined the capture technique for capturing loons, and he was beginning to capture and mark large numbers of them. And what he found was that often loons got booted off of their lakes, and at what seemed to be a higher rate than we normally would expect that to happen, that had been observed in other species. And I told him, wow, that's very interesting. Someone should study that. And he didn't have any particular interest in that, in the behavior. He was interested in the potential impact of mercury on loons and some other conservation questions. But over the course of a couple of years saying, well, someone should study that. That's very interesting. I finally talked myself into it. So that's how I got into it to start with.
And one of the things you study is territoriality and how birds defend territoriality. And loons, what sort of contributes to their romantic image in the North Woods is the idea that if you live on a little lake and you have a pair of breeding loons, they're going to come back year after year after year after year. And really, many times for 10, 15 years.
That's right. And they're long-lived animals. We're only now beginning to learn how long-lived they are, really, because it's only been in the last 20 or so years that we've had good numbers of them marked, and we know that a lot of them that we marked 20 years ago are still alive now.
Wow.
So we're wondering how long-lived they really are. They have strong sight fidelity. That is, there's a very strong tendency for them to come back year after year, to return year after year to the same territory. They have a very strong affiliation with that territory. And even if one's mate gets evicted, gets kicked off of that territory by another bird, the you will come back, even if you've lost your mate, and hold on to that territory and keep returning to that territory. And you will, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with sort of attitude. Your affiliation is to the lake. Not to the pair.
That's another part of the romantic image of loons, is that they mate for life.
Yeah,
that's,
I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, no.
to have
don't.
Dispelled that.
They don't. But right. As long as they're in their habitat together, they do.
They're serially monogamous. Mm-hmm. They're not perfect, if you want to view from a human through a human prism. But they, within a year, they remain paired. There's no hanky panky. They're genetically monogamous, as we say, which means that they do not mate with other individuals outside of the pair bond. So that all of the chicks that are reared by a pair are the biological offspring of both pair members. So that's saying something, given that in many species of animals, there's mating that goes on outside of the pair bond, and so you don't get genetic monogamy of that kind.
Now, given the fact that they come back to the same location year after year, if you find a good location, I would think the competition for that location is pretty keen?
You would think so, and it probably is. On some level, it is, and the longer you study something, the more you realize the subtleties, the aspects of it that weren't as simple as you thought initially they might be. Yes, there is a strong tendency for loons to return to the same territory themselves. And also, if they produce chicks, what we've learned is that there's a strong tendency for territorial intruders, that is, young birds in most cases, who are trying themselves to get a territory, who are adults but have not yet settled on a territory. There's a strong tendency for them to intrude into lakes that produced chicks the previous year. And apparently what they're doing is they're trying to target successful lakes, proven successful lakes for intrusion. And those intrusions, I should say, also often lead to evictions, that is, lead to efforts on the part of those intruders to take over the territory subsequently.
Now, I was reading your blog. You have a wonderful website where you explain what you're researching for the lake, and it's called The Loon Project. And one of the things on your blog you were talking about is you kind of had sort of an aha moment here recently where you were looking at, and it makes perfect sense, but I guess until the research tells you this, that evictions, and we should mention what these evictions, these are violent encounters between the males in which a lot of times the loser dies.
Now, males and females, both. Uh-huh. Yes. And actually, they both, with equal frequency, males and females will obtain territories by eviction. However, you're right, there is a difference between the males and the females in that the males fight more violently for reasons that we don't yet understand. The males will often fight to the death for their territories, fight what seems to us to be too hard for their territories, whereas the females are able somehow to recognize that things are going badly for them in the battle and then and survive to live another day and move to another territory where they try to breed.
But what you found is when these violent encounters is you found an age correlation.
That's right.
It happens early in life when they're not fully mature, and then at the end of the life as they're growing old.
Right. I mean, one of the benefits of working hard and marking a lot of birds and following them and weighing them and following them over many years, which you must to learn such patterns, is that, yes, things change over time, over the lives of individuals. And, yes, what we've learned very recently, and this wasn't known despite the loon actually being one of the better studied species now in North America, is that loons do deteriorate. They senesce. And as you say, yes, the young loons also are not, when they're 4, 5, 6 years old, they're not in prime condition. So they have a prime of life, just as humans do. So this is something that resonates pretty well with us, and we can understand. But we had never found it in loons before. But when they're 4, 5, 6 years old, they're not in prime quality. And we can confirm that by weighing them and seeing that their body mass peaks when they get to be about 9, 10, 11 years old. And sort of plateaus from there, although we suspect it also declines because, as you say, this finding is also that survival, both survival and rate of eviction, that is the danger of losing your territory, increases greatly as you get into your 20s. It seems to be relatively abrupt that as you get into about 23, 24, 25 years of age, you don't have it together as you did when you were in your teens. And there's a very high rate of eviction and also a high rate of mortality.
You're mentioning your blog. It's like it may be one of the reasons why they will fight to the death because at this point they're like, I have got nothing left to lose.
That's right. It's the so-called the terminal investment idea, which is that if you have little expectation of future reproductive success, and you know that, and that's a critical aspect too, that loons on some level know it or have been selected to behave in such as if they know it, that when you get into your mid-20s, if you have very little future prospects of reproduction, you might behave in such a way as to really put an emphasis on reproducing in the next year or two. And that could include defending your territory extra hard or investing an extra amount of care in the few additional young that you're likely to have during your life. So that may explain the fatal fighting that we see in males.
Now, the other thing you discuss in how the couple, the male and female, choose their territory and how they work in raising chicks, the male is very much involved. The male chooses the site.
That's right. They're a shining example to all of us of egalitarian child rearing and territory defense. In fact, if anything, the males do a bit more of child rearing than the females. Now, I should say quickly that the males are larger than the females. They're about 20 to 25% larger. And so you could argue the males are better equipped to defend the chicks from whatever may attack them, which might include eagles or other loons. Often other loons come in and threaten the chicks and sometimes kill the chicks. Also, only males are capable of giving the territorial call, which is called the yodel. Mm-hmm. And it's a call that conveys aggression very clearly, and it conveys the likelihood of an attack. That is, if a male gives a yodel when an intruder, a would-be intruder, is flying over and the intruder chooses to land, there's a good chance that intruder will be attacked. So it's a warning signal that makes males perhaps a bit more effective at defending their chicks than females who can't give the yodel would be.
Now, when loons kill the chicks of other competitive couples, is it a matter of just trying to eliminate the competition, or
it's
or
hard,
like an eagle would be for predation?
It's hard to know. There are a couple of different contexts in which it occurs, really two main contexts. One is the context of territorial eviction. That is to say, if you are young male or female, usually a young male in this case, and you're trying to take over a territory, and you take over a territory on which there are chicks, you will take over that territory, you'll drive the male off, possibly kill that male, and then you will probably kill the chicks. That's when chicks are commonly killed. So then that's something we see in other animals as well. Lions do that, for example.
People used to do that a lot.
Yes, yes. So it's not unheard of, and it makes some sense in that case, because why would, as a new male, why would you invest in offspring that aren't your own offspring?
Right.
But there are also so-called rogue loons that intrude into territories and kill young chicks without any obvious benefit coming to them from that behavior. But the problem with assessing and determining what that behavior might be motivated by is that these chicks are usually very small when they're killed, and it doesn't take much energy for a loon to kill those chicks. If it were a costly behavior, we could say, well, we need to really study this, and we should expect there to be a very good explanation for why they do this. But if it's a low-cost behavior, it might be that it only gives them a tiny bit of benefit. Maybe having your chicks killed makes you a little less likely to stay on that territory the next year. So it might loosen the hold of a breeding male or female for its territory and allow you as an intruder to come in and take over that territory later.
By cost, you're talking about the threat of injury,
right,
or energy expenditure.
That's right. That's right. Relatively low energy expenditure, because loons are 10 or 12 pound birds, and the chicks are going to weigh a quarter of a pound or less at the age that they're killed. And so a couple of blows with your bill to a chick, and that chick's going to die, and it hasn't cost you much. And even if it nets you relatively little benefit, it might have been worth doing.
Yeah. The breeding success is a big part of this bird's DNA.
Right. I mean, we presume that loons and other species as well have evolved in such a way as to maximize their own reproductive success, and have been tuned over many generations to do so. And generally, we find they're pretty good explanations for the behavior that we see them exhibit.
My guest today is Walter Piper, a professor of earth and environmental science at Chapman University. For 22 years, he's been studying loons up in northern Wisconsin, I believe, and you can see his website, The Loon Project, which summarizes his research, and he's a guest of the University of Tulsa, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, when we talk about northern species, I think a lot of, you know, we think polar bears, you know, and other right. other species in the far north, there's no, they can't go any further north with climate change. Have you seen any effects of climate change on loon behavior, on their numbers? I, from what I can see, the loon populations are pretty stable in the area you're studying.
They're stable or even growing in most areas, and partly this seems to be continued recovery from a variety of things, but it could be partly DDT, the impacts of DDT, other impacts of humans that loons have bounced back from. So in our study area in northern Wisconsin, as you say, the population is higher now than it's been in recent record. We know it's a lot higher than it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago.
I'm thinking about the wildlife conservation movements like Ducks Unlimited. Have they benefited from habitat that have, you know, been given towards game species like ducks and geese?
No doubt they have to some degree, although loons mm-hmm. are different in their migration patterns and so forth than loons are very different from ducks in that respect. So I think there's been some benefit, certainly. Loons, one major benefit that loons have that allows them to live side by side with humans, as they do in my study area in northern Wisconsin, is that loons prefer to nest in areas where they're difficult for humans to build in. For example, one of their favorite places to nest is on marshy or boggy habitat, and it's so expensive to build or impossible to build because you have to fill in that habitat if you'd like to live there, that generally humans will say, well, that's a marsh. There's no point in, you know, it's hard to even put a road in there. I can't live there. And so the loons are able to live side by side. Sometimes it's a large lake that has a small marshy area, and the loons have they're sequestered in this little marshy area where they can nest and raise their young, and the humans can hang out in areas where there's upland habitat where they can build their homes.
Now, certain species have learned to adapt to humans and find that the presence of humans eliminates other predators. Any sign of that with loons?
I don't think so in the case of loons.
They're pretty skittish around humans.
Well, actually, they were in northern Ontario, and in areas where there isn't a high density of humans, they are quite skittish. But really, we are able to study loons in our study area because they're relatively tame. They do allow us to approach often within 2 or 3 meters, and which means that we can look at their colored leg bands that we put on their legs and say, oh, that's silver over red, orange over blue, and so forth. And so so loons have do allow us to approach quite close and have become quite tame. So that's something that's very beneficial to our study.
Yeah. Now, a lot of people studying migratory bird patterns have seen some changes, like birds arriving to habitat earlier. Any sign of that with loons? Or are they pretty much weather-dependent on how each season is because they're landing on water?
They do seem to be highly weather-dependent. And of course, as you folks know here, winters can be very severe or quite mild, and you've had examples of that recently, I think, here, and as we have up in northern Wisconsin for the same reason. And so, yes, I think the impact of a mild winter or a severe winter tends to be so strong. That is, the year-to-year fluctuations tend to be so strong as an influence of migration patterns and settlement patterns on their territories that seems to wash out or swamp any potential effect that we might be able to detect with something like climate change. That also, together with the fact that loons are strongly sight faithful, so they have a very strong tendency to return to their lake even if the lake level falls pretty far. We've had some lakes that start off being 4 or 5 feet deep only. They're quite shallow and have gone now to being 2 feet deep, and because there have been some droughts and some water losses in recent years. But the loons continue to come back faithfully to those lakes and defend them because that's just part of their being and what has generally worked well for them in the past.
Mm. My guest today is Walter Piper, a professor of earth and environmental science at Chapman University. He's been studying loon behavior and their territoriality for over 20 years, and he's a guest of the University of Tulsa. You know, a lot of times when people are studying animal species and really getting to know the ins and outs of how they behave, there a lot of people will sometimes ask, what is our understanding benefit from knowing this animal's behavior? What have you found about loons that help us understand more about who we are?
About human behavior.
Yeah.
Well, I think, of course, humans have territorial inclinations just as loons do. And so by studying the aggression of loons and how loons progress from as young individuals without a territorial stake to older individuals who have territories and defend those territories, I think there is a ability to achieve some sort of general understanding for how animals go through these stages, which again are relatively similar. They're pretty good parallels between what humans and loons do, despite the fact that they seem to be quite different animals. So I think there's a lot to be learned there. I thought also you were going to ask about what's the value of studying loons, period. And you know, loons have an enormous value to folks who live around loons, folks in the northern U.S. and Canada across their range, because they have they're this sort of magical bird with these wonderful calls, and they're beautiful, mysterious birds that dive and then resurface hundreds of meters away. And so people get very invested in loons. Of course, they're the state birds of a number of states, and they're all over license plates. And so there's a lot of folks who work in Chicago and Milwaukee, for example, and drive up to the North Woods and love the idea of waking up on a lake that has a loon on it and hearing the calls of the loon.
Yeah, going to sleep with them and waking up with them.
Yeah, right. And so there's that. I mean, loons have a substantial charisma. and people really do love them. And so I feel like a major part of my task, in addition to learning some science and learning about what they're doing behaviorally, is helping to learn how we can conserve them and threats that loons face.
Walter Piper, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Walter Piper is a professor of Earth and Environmental Science at Chapman University. He'll be speaking on the University of Tulsa campus about his research on the common loon this afternoon at 3 o'clock in Oliphant Hall, room 300. For more information on his research, you can visit his website at loonproject.org. You're listening to Studio Tulsa, and here's another story from the StoryCorps booth in downtown Tulsa. Moises Echeverria and Stuart Ashworth are young professionals who live and work in Tulsa. They've been partners for about 2 years now. In this StoryCorps conversation, they talk about the recent Supreme Court decision that overturned the gay marriage ban in Oklahoma. This landmark decision actually got them thinking about their own plans to marry someday. Moises begins the dialogue.
So I saw the announcement early in the morning that the Supreme Court had refused to hear that case, and I had no idea what that meant. So this is October 6, 2014.
Yes.
I remember I texted you, and I said, oh my gosh, do you see that article? And then I said, what does that mean?
And for me, like, it caught me off guard, but I immediately knew what it meant because, I mean, I went to law school. I'm an attorney. I know what that meant. We now have the right to marry. It can never be taken away, even if the Supreme Court decides to pick it up in another state to hear it. And if they overturn it or whatever, in Oklahoma, we have that right forever. To be honest, I did not get any work done that entire day. So, like, this was at 9 o'clock in the morning. I was freaking out. I was happy. I was like texting friends. It was amazing. And that particular case that went before the 10th Circuit, which was refused to be heard by the Supreme Court, the plaintiffs in that case, they were getting married that day. They posted on Facebook, they're getting married. And so I texted Moises. I said, we need to be at that wedding. The first same-sex wedding in Tulsa, in Oklahoma. And he's like, okay. Then we found out it's going to be at 5 o'clock. So I'm like, okay, we'll take off early. I'll meet you there downtown. We went there. We were at the first ceremony.
And what was special about it to me, of course, it was a lot of, I think every news station and newspaper was there. But what was special to me was that there was no protesters. And even though we were right next to this really busy street, and we were on the sidewalk, and there's all these cars driving by. Like, there was no one who was like mean or hateful or angry. So I just felt really nice. And as I stood there looking at these two women who have been fighting for this right for many, many years, stand there facing each other and be married, it was just inspirational.
And they filed this lawsuit 10 years ago. I never met them a day in my life, but I knew I wanted to be at their wedding because I wanted to see history in making. And I want to be able to tell our kids, hey, there was one point we were not able to marry. And then it changed. And we were at that first wedding. We were there.
So growing up, I think I safe to say that both of us, because the way we were raised, we had an idea of what our wedding was expected to look like. And we tried to accept that until we realized that we did not have those attractions to people who are female.
Yeah.
And so at some point we had to accept that we were never going to get married, and that we were going to have a partner, but not a religious ceremony or standing before a judge or anything like that to make our union legal.
I mean, I had friends in high school and in college, and they're like, oh, I want to have doves in my wedding. I want to have... yeah, I mean, there's some crazy wedding ideas out there. And they're like, Stuart, what would you like at your wedding? And I was like, well, I haven't given any thought into it. So October the 6th was only 19 days ago when we were given the right to marry. So after that day, that's when everything started to change. And I'm like, oh my goodness, what does this really mean? This means I get to get married. What will my wedding look like? And I was like, where are we going to get married at? What am I going to wear? Who are we going to invite? Will our family come to the wedding? These are questions that were just brand new to us. I think these are questions that straight couples, it's normal for them, but it's not something that we think about. And all of a sudden, it's like we started thinking about this stuff. It wasn't a burden. I enjoyed thinking about it, but I was like, it's so overwhelming.
So now we're trying to figure out the details, and yeah. I want a small backyard type of deal, intimate wedding, and you want a big, fancy...
I really want a flashy wedding. but I mean, it's like, realistically, like, will my parents, how much will they help us with? If they will at all. So we don't know. And about venues, and we're thinking about dates, and Moises is really, you're trying to push me for a date. And trying to get a date, and I was like, I haven't even proposed yet. I haven't even bought a ring. And I was like, I'm really feeling pressure. I'm like, and then I'm like, is there a gay wedding etiquette? I don't really know. But I think we're pioneering this, so we whatever we do becomes etiquette for the next generation. So I think that's really cool.
Stuart Ashworth and Moises Echeverria speaking at the StoryCorps mobile booth at the Guthrie Green in downtown Tulsa. This marks the final weekend for StoryCorps in Tulsa, and we'll be having a special listening party this evening at 6:30 at the Zero Center across the street from the booth in downtown Tulsa. You're more than welcome to attend. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.